This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In December of 1931, a group of men and women were arrested at the Heart of New York Gymnasium for exercising in the buff. 24 seized in raid on nudist cult, read the New York Times headline. Shortly thereafter, the same newspaper reported that Judge Jonah Goldstein dismissed the charges against the so-called cult, stating that what is all right on the beach today would have meant arrest 3 years ago. It is a story told at the start of a new book called Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. And author Brian Hoffman joins us now with more. Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So your book is about American nudism, but nudism as a movement was largely exported to the U.S. from Germany. So give us a story there.
Sure. So in Germany, this has been happening as part of a larger movement called Lebensreform, which is this kind of return to nature. They believed in natural healing, they're against alcohol consumption, and they also believed that going naked was a way to return to nature.
And when was this?
1905 is, I think, the way most historians mark it, and it definitely is kind of what sparks these nudist camps that both develop in the German countryside, but also in the urban areas.
So what was going on in America in the late 20s and early 30s when this Heart of New York Gymnasium raid took place? What kind of cultural forces were paving the way for American nudism at that time?
In America, you're seeing this like gradual shift away from the moral absolutism of the 19th century, that the discussion of sex had to really be kept secret or repressed. This is moving away. We're starting to see a greater acceptance of birth control, of kind of titillating films, books dealing with controversial subjects are now being accepted. And so with this shift away from kind of sexual repression, you see people kind of open up to the idea of nudism in the United States. You start seeing books of travel narratives from Americans who have visited German camps become very popular. And then you have kind of German immigrants groups wanting to recreate the Nackt culture experience that they had enjoyed in Germany.
Nackt culture?
Nackt culture is like basically culture of the nude.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start developing these very small groups in kind of immigrant communities, New York City, Chicago. In America, though, it expands beyond that. So it becomes kind of a phenomenon where you have people from all walks of life choosing to go naked as a way of combating shame in America, but also promoting health.
Mm-hmm. This is at a time when there were a lot of reactionary movements to industrialism and urbanization in American life.
So yes, during the Progressive Era, there's a great deal of concern about diseases of darkness, things like rickets or tuberculosis. Doctors would all the time send people out west to places like New Mexico and Arizona to have that dry climate, the exposure to the sun. So nudists build on that by removing the clothes in nudist camps, in gymnasiums. They not only soak up the sun and get vitamin D production going, which is supposed to be good for all different sorts of things, but also removing the clothes, allowing the glands, the sweat glands, to do what they're naturally supposed to do. And this becomes quite popular as nudists practice it, but also in the medical profession, and in hospitals would have solariums. So it's that kind of idea that the sun is a cure, that it is therapeutic, that allows nudists to kind of appeal to a whole segment of American society that's interested in natural healing and alternative medicine.
So that's what's going on socially. How about legally? What was the landscape for nudism in the 1930s?
Definitely legal history is part of what makes nudism possible. The American Civil Liberties Union are trying to open up expression in the United States, especially in the first decades of the 20th century. And nudism becomes part of that struggle. The first thing that kind of falls is like books with literary and scholarly merit, which is what really allows nudist books to be on the open market in the United States. But they do become embroiled in other cases because they walk this fine line of what is and isn't acceptable, what is illicit and what is respectable. And actually, that's one of the fascinating things to me about this movement. There are people who are sincerely about health and combating shame, but then there are others who are about also promoting the eroticism of the naked body to make a quick buck. But the line is never clear. And I think it speaks to the way Americans kind of understand the naked body, which is it has these contradictory and multiple functions of being about health and beauty and aesthetics, but also about eroticism and pornography. And so that line is a question that really challenges the courts from really the time nudism begins in the early 1930s all the way into the 1960s and 70s.
Well, let's talk about making a buck. Central to the nudism movement was this flagship magazine. It was called Sunshine and Health.
Yes.
Now, this is something that people gravitated toward because it did have, you know, photographs of naked people. But first, how important was this publication to organizing and actually promoting American nudism?
Yeah, it was really essential to putting nudism on the map in the United States. After these books kind of run their course, it's the magazine that allows the early nudist organizations to communicate about camps, about their philosophy, about what's happening in the movement. It is their internet of the day. So it was critical to establishing the movement in the United States. And the man who's really behind it is this guy. He's a fascinating character, the Reverend Illy Boone. And he is really critical to these magazines, fighting for the legal right to publish them, and then promoting them.
Yeah, the post office didn't even want to deliver these magazines. So there is this undeniably erotic aspect to nudism. Now, how did that start to shape public perception about nudism during and after World War II, when there was a general sort of liberalization of the culture?
During the Second World War, because you have so many troops in all-male environments away from home, they become much more accepting of things like pinups.
Right. And Betty Grable is at everyone's bunk, right?
Yes, everyone. All these actresses, pinups everywhere, on airplanes, all over the place. And it's part of accepted is the culture. And so you get these reports from soldiers writing into Sunshine Health thanking them for making such a wonderful magazine that's circulating around the barracks. And the nudists reprint this in their magazines, and they're proud to be part of this war effort. It not only allows the nudist movement to kind of support itself during the war through these magazines, but after the war, people are aware of the camps, and they want to see them. And so when they come back, you see an explosion of membership in nudist camps that I think is really growing out of the exposure nudism gained through the armed forces.
But you also have what you call the single man problem at these nudist resorts. Now, what is that exactly?
The single man problem definitely grows out of this popularity that these nudist magazines had during the Second World War. You get a lot of single men coming to these camps. But single men, they are somewhat suspect. They could be there to soak up the sun. On the other hand, they could also be there as voyeurs. They can be there to be looking for sexual, you know, trysts. They could be there to check out other men. And this was something that was a constant tension at many nudist camps, especially as they saw their membership skew heavily male.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of threatened what nudism was all about during this period, which is about the family and being heteronormative.
But it sounds kind of like a precursor to the kind of problems that many, you know, nightclubs have had through the ages, and now dating sites are coping with, heavily male skewed.
Yes, absolutely. Like, these things attract the attention of men. And nudism was no exception, definitely a precursor to those kind of things where you have bars that, you know, attract women with, you know, free drinks and dating sites that give women extra freebies. I think, you know, whereas men have to pay for certain things, women don't have to pay to access different accounts. And nudist clubs were doing the same thing, that they would offer cheaper memberships for women or more expensive memberships for single men, that they had to carry their weight if they weren't bringing their family with them. In New Hampshire, there's Cedars Waters Village, and they still only allow couples. Mm-hmm. Like, that is their rule. Only men can come with when they're accompanied with women. That is largely faded from most camps nowadays. It's much more open. This is a privately held camp, and they've been around since 1950. And they're holding on to those kind of rules that were established in this post-war period.
Well, you know, I've been hearing about that camp my entire life growing up in New Hampshire. I think we all sort of get this idea about it, and it, you know, tinged with this sense of illicitness. But you spoke to the kind of heteronormative formation of these camps, especially at that time. This was liberalization, I guess, on some level, but not quite, still very family-centric. What was there a tension there?
Yes, there's an acceptance now that, you know, people have sex. You know, it is part of life. Men and women, people accept the dating culture. They accept that they're going to go to the movies, that there's this petting culture before marriage. But as long as that's kind of contained within the male-female relationship between marriage, ultimately resulting in a family and normalcy, then in American society, that type of sexuality is fine. What's not accepted are things that go against the grain, such as homosexual relationships, interracial intimacy, and the real kind of elephant in the room is the intergenerational sexuality or pedophilia, child molestation. These things raise major concerns, both within nudism, but also outside, people looking in at camps. Like, what's going on behind those walls, those fences?
I'm speaking with Brian Hoffman. He's author of the book Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism, which traces nudism from its roots in Germany to the rise of the family nudist resort and much beyond. How about the sexual revolution and the sort of hippie and free love movement in the 1960s? How did that change nudist culture?
Yes, the counterculture 1960s, it is really interesting. It's one of the things I enjoyed writing most about this book, is how fractured the movement becomes during this period. In the 1960s, there's this new generation that wants to use nudity, and specifically public nudity, to challenge what they see as being the hypocritical values of American society. So they no longer want to confine themselves to these camps. They want to be on the beach. They want to be in the park. And they want to have the right to kind of unclothe and to undress where and when they want as a way of being authentic. This is what the nudist movement then becomes, is this like loose assortment of organizations and groups and people that is much more confrontational about public nudity in a lot of different spaces. These nudists, these new generation of counterculture kind of hippies going naked, definitely conflict with an older generation that is much more about respectability and is not comfortable with the kind of erotic implications of the naked body.
But how about today in this kind of super sexualized culture, a nude resort for adults anyway, seems almost, I don't know, quaint or for, you know, oddballs, I guess, might be the reputation that goes on. But then again, there are still campaigns to free the nipple, you know, debates over public breastfeeding and laws that continue to make public nudity a criminal act. So has our culture's relationship with nudity changed all that much?
You know, I've been following the Free the Nipple campaign and a lot of the different things going on. I really
maybe you should first tell people what it is, because I'm not sure everyone knows.
Sure. So there's been an effort by celebrities, but also everyday people, that women should have the right to kind of display their bodies in the same way a man is generally able to display his chest or torso, mm-hmm. whether they're on the beach or in their homes, or really it's on Facebook or Instagram. And what you're seeing is a different conversation emerging about what should and shouldn't be seen. We're no longer talking about judges or the government saying it's wrong or illegal to display your breasts on Facebook. It's Mark Zuckerberg. And I think that's different. When we are producing the content, when we are deciding to display it, and we decide who our friends are, we feel that no company should tell us what we can and cannot show. So I think that's really different. The other thing that's going on, I think, in American society or even in the world, is the digitization of life has made us much more comfortable displaying our bodies. We take selfies now. These selfies are often of us on clothes. And because we don't have to worry about bringing them in to be developed anywhere, that they're ours, they're private, we keep them on our phones or on our computers, we've become comfortable with seeing our naked bodies and showing them. I don't think nakedness is as big a deal, especially for the younger digitized generation. And it's something that nudists have embraced. It's actually as strong a movement as it's ever been. It's a $400 million industry that is kind of accepting a tremendous growth in its membership at this point. There's all sorts of events, naked cycling movements and free the nipple, naked protests all the time. When I was in San Francisco, the Castro was having this debate about people going naked on the street there. And it wasn't a debate about completely banning it, but like having them bring their towels when they sit down. Hmm. So I do think things are shifting quite dramatically. The fact that these things are going on is, I think, a reflection that people's attitudes are changing.
Brian Hoffman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Hoffman, he's author of Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. You'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Like many of life's bold or uncomfortable moments, when it comes to nudism, there's a first time for everything. WNPR producer Kion Wolf visited Solaire Family Nudist Resort in Woodstock, Connecticut, to fully experience life as a nudist for the first time. She brought us this story.
I am parked on the side of the road before getting to Solaire Family Nudist Resort in Woodstock, Connecticut, and I'm feeling excited, a little anxious, so let's just get on with this. I want to get there. Here we go. And this big gate is opening after I ring the doorbell. It says, welcome back for a nude year at Solaire. They crossed out the new and put nude. That's my kind of humor.
Paul? Hi, I figured I'd give it a shot right from the start. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
I want to bring back my four-wheel, and I got a golf cart. I can take you around on the golf cart. And then
that's beautiful.
You can decide at what point you want to disrobe, if you want to disrobe at all.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do. I definitely do.
Okay, did you bring do you have a sarong or something that you want to throw on to start with, or are you just ready to go full boat?
Let's just do it.
All right, let's go down my site. Then you can disrobe down there.
Perfect.
All right, so you'll follow me down.
Now, I got to ask. In terms of etiquette, like right now, I'm making sure that I'm staring at your face.
You can look anywhere you want. We're all nude. You're going to look at people.
That's the point, I guess.
Yeah. That's the whole thing. It doesn't make a difference.
But I'm like, looking at your
eyes. You do what you want. Until you feel comfortable, you look at my eyes.
All right. That sounds good. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. How long did it take you to get yourself psyched up to do this?
Here's my thought. I should be as nervous to come here as I would to go to the OBGYN. It's nothing they haven't seen. It's nothing you haven't seen. So mentally, you know, no problem. But there's a part of my brain that's like, never done this before.
If you spent 15 minutes here in clothes, you'd feel uncomfortable.
How do I take my clothes off?
I think you're good at that. You can go inside my trailer, take your clothes off the side. How's that?
No,
did you bring a towel? Or?
No, I don't know.
I'll give you a towel.
Thank you.
That's part of the etiquette. You need to sit on a towel.
That makes sense.
Okay.
All right.
We only have two spots in camp that you are absolutely required to be nude. That's on the beach and at the pool. Every place else is clothing optional. We prefer to everybody be nude all the time, but it's your prerogative.
Fair. Yeah.
Okay?
So sit on a towel.
Sit on
Number
a towel.
One rule.
Number one.
Number two rule, sit on a towel.
There you go.
All right. So just head on in there and...
You go head in there and take your time. I'll wait out here for you.
Thanks all a right. lot. And now I'm naked. Okay. I feel oddly fine. Okay.
All right.
You ready? Huh. So I feel awfully white right now.
Well, yeah,
you're next
you are
to you.
Kind of white.
Yeah, you're super tan. Here we are riding in your golf cart, and there's a nice breeze. And I'm feeling breezes in places that I had never felt breezes before. It's really nice.
It's different, right?
It's different. I like it. I like it.
Well, that's a good thing.
I can see how you get used to this.
I have to congratulate you on how easy it was for you to disrobe.
I've never heard those words before in my life. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
It's been, 5 minutes? I feel great. It's like instantly... Awesome. And of course, it would be different if I were at a grocery store in Manhattan. You know what I mean? But being here and knowing that, hey, we're all on the same level, that is really cool. And you feel it right away.
Yeah.
I like it.
And that's the thing. There's no status here. Everybody's on the same playing field. This guy could be picking up trash and this guy could be a doctor. We don't know.
Except people with awesome tattoos are pretty. We do have something
there's
to offer.
There's a distinction in that, sure.
There's a couple of people here that's got some pretty nice tattoos.
I'm sure I would see.
Yeah.
I told my mom about this, and her pitch went up about 3 octaves, but she said, well, somebody from the station is going to go with you, right? And I'm like, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? No one's coming from the radio station with me here.
And that's the stigma. Single women can't come here by themselves because it's not appropriate, and that's so far from the truth.
That's true. If there's anywhere on the planet that I could take all my clothes off and not in my own home that's safe, it would be here.
Exactly.
And I have to just make a comment right now. My upper body is in shadow. My butt is in the sun. Feels great.
It does.
Feels like I've never had my butt in the sun.
This is the first time she's ever taken her clothes off.
The only way to travel.
Putting your butt in the sun or naked altogether?
Naked altogether.
Right now, having my butt in the sun is really ridiculously pleasing. It's really nice. Do I have to put my clothes back on? I have to.
Well, you can drive home. You can drive home nude if you want.
But officer, I just came from Solaire.
What do you think a cop's going to say if he stops a woman and she's driving there nude? He's just going to look at you and he's going to go, just go home. Go ahead, go.
And I could experience the breeze. I'm going to think about that.
You already experienced the breeze.
Yeah. But it's funny, as I was putting my clothes back on, I was thinking, in any other circumstance, I'd be afraid someone would walk in on me. Meh.
I did the gentlemanly thing and stayed outside.
Well, yeah. And now here I am standing on your front porch in my bra because...
It's hot.
Because it's hot, and I didn't have to put anything else on because I'm going to keep my shirt off. Screw that. I'm going to my car. I'm going to keep my bra on. People will think it's a bathing suit top.
There you go.
They don't know the difference.
There you go.
Thanks again. Thank you enough.
I'll see you on Tuesday.
Can't wait.
All right. Take care.
You too. I have a lot of absorbing to do. It's kind of messing with my head a little bit, in a good way. I felt instantly leveled with everybody there. Paul at one point told me, of all the people you talked to today, two of them are multimillionaires. But, I didn't have time to notice their cufflinks or their designer tie so I could straighten up my posture. I can understand how you could be regularly around people completely naked and just see each other for who you are. In a way, you want to be like, no big deal. And in a way, it's a really big deal. I have a lot to think about. And I'm so driving home in my bra.
And that story came to us from producer Kion Wolf. A few days ago, I went into a studio and Googled the word happiness.
All right, so here are some headlines about happiness. Want to find happiness? Do this one thing in the shower. Four steps to finding joy and happiness in your bipolar life. Wow, that's kind of specific. Why are older Danish women so happy? Money really does buy happiness in one map. Depressed Botox may be the key to happiness. We all know that. The world, it would seem, is obsessed with the notion that there is a secret to happiness. And judging by the number of books and articles on the subject, it's a formula we have yet to discover. One of the many people exploring what it means to be happy is the French philosopher Frédéric Lenoir. His new book, Happiness, A Philosopher's Guide, is not your typical self-help book, but it does contain the optimistic view that lasting happiness is indeed possible. And Frédéric Lenoir, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia.
There have been so many quotes and ideas about the nature of happiness that we hear again and again. We hear money cannot buy you happiness. You can't rely on others to make you happy. That happiness is a state of mind. But we either don't absorb these lessons or we don't believe them. Why do you think it is that we resist them?
I think there are, of course, many theories about happiness. And as you said, the most important thing is to understand that happiness is a state of mind. I would say it's a state of being. People confuse pleasure and happiness all the time. Pleasure is a short-lived experience. Happiness is a state of being. You get pleasure when you get satisfaction from a need or desire. And you're happy because you feel good inside yourself. And in order to do that, you have to find with your reason the correct pleasures and experience those pleasures in moderation. Happiness is a quest for balance, harmony, serenity. And many people, when they say I'm happy, they only have good pleasures because they lack the job they have, they lack the family, they have pleasure in life. But if tomorrow they lose a job, if they separate, and they will be very unhappy.
I think so many of us have the idea that we are supposed to be happy. Does that pressure to be happy get in the way of actually being happy?
I think the pressure is not good for happiness. Happiness must not be an obligation. I was in the United States for 2 months to learn English 3 months ago. And then I was very surprised in New York City that all people said, oh, I'm so happy, I'm very happy. And I was thinking, it's not always true. And I thought that if they said, I'm unhappy or it's difficult, people will think they are losers, you know, and that it would be difficult in their culture to say that everything is not perfect. And in France, it's exactly the opposite. Most of the people, if you ask them, are you happy? They will say, oh, I'm not so happy. It's difficult. Life is so difficult. But they are quite happy also. But they don't want to say they are happy because they don't want to be obliged to be happy. And I think it's very interesting to discover this cultural difference.
It is interesting. I mean, there's also the sense of sort of competition about being happy. What is the quote from Seneca? No one will be happy if tormented by the thought that another is happier.
That's right. We don't have to compare because there will be always someone who is happier, who is richer, who is more successful. And then if we compare to other people, we will be always unhappy. And it's the reason why also Émile Zola, you know, the French writer, he said that it's to be poor in Paris, and we can say the same in the American big cities, to be poor in Paris is to be poor twice, because you will compare yourself to other people who are richer than you.
Right, the sort of relative deprivation is revealed. But I'm glad you're talking about environments, because there is a lot of debate, of course, among sociologists and psychologists and other scientists about the question of nature versus nurture. You're suggesting that one can adopt a state of mind that sees happiness. In fact, you give an example in the book of a woman who's in a concentration camp and keeps a journal that is all about not letting that horrible experience rob her spirit or determination to be happy. How much of our happiness is dependent on our surroundings versus our attitude?
The first philosopher who asked this question was Aristotle. He underlined the crucial point that an individual's capacity for happiness are three factors. First, and for him least influential, are exterior condition, environment, family, society, culture. He said the second point, more important, is luck. Our lucky star, our divine providence, that gave us a good nature. We will say today, a good genes. And third, our practice, knowledge, spiritual exercise, virtues, behavior. And what is very interesting is that today, the professor Sonia Lubominsky from University of California say exactly the same thing. She explained that happiness depends for 10% on external conditions, 50% on genetics, and 40% on our voluntary activities. Of course, environment is important. Of course, genetics and luck is important. But you can also decide to be happy, and you can practice, and you can do many things that will help you to be happier, even if you had bad genes, if you are no lucky. Everyone can be happy if he decides to be happy.
Well, when you're talking about philosophers, by and large, they have not always been the best examples of happy individuals, have they? Should we really be looking to them for advice?
It's a good question. I think it depends on philosophers. And I would tell you, when I made this book, I discovered something very interesting. The philosophers who didn't believe in happiness, because there are many philosophers who said happiness doesn't exist.
Right.
Only pleasure exists. And when you have a lot of pleasure, you say I'm happy. But only pleasure exists. Those philosophers were not happy. They were unhappy. Like Schopenhauer, you know, like Freud, like Kant. Many philosophers said happiness is impossible to reach happiness because they were unhappy. And other philosophers, like Montaigne, like Epicurus, like Spinoza, the Dutch philosopher from 17th century, were very happy, and they said it's possible to reach happiness. So I think, of course, it depends on the experience of the philosophers. And something that was also very interesting for me to discover is that some philosophers said that to be happy, the most important thing is to live in the present, to focus on the present time. And today, cognitive science say exactly the same thing. So it's interesting to understand that the modern science can confirm, can say the same thing than old philosophers from 2,000 years.
How about the philosopher Frederick Lenoir? Would you say that researching and writing this book has made you a happier person?
I think that I would tell you my own experience. When I was a teenager, I was not so happy. I think I had a low self-esteem, and I decided to work on myself. I read philosophers, I went to therapy, I learned to meditate, and in the end, I got to know and to love myself better, and then step by step, I became truly happy. So it's the reason why I decided to write this book and to try to understand what is happiness, because it was my journey, and I tried to share this experience with other people.
Well, Frederick Lenoir, thank you for sharing that experience with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It was a great pleasure to speak with you.
Frederick Lenoir is a philosopher, a radio talk show host, and author. His newest book has recently been translated into English by Andrew Brown, and it's called Happiness, A Philosopher's Guide. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Unexplained phenomena often involve things that we can see but have no explanation for. UFOs or elaborate crop circles, or why do some people think that dress is blue and black when it's clearly gold and white? But what about the things we can hear but have no explanation for? Producer Logan Shannon presents some audio mysteries.
In a normal radio story, I would either introduce a sound before playing it or play a sound and then immediately identify it. This is not a normal radio story. I have no idea what that is.
My name is Caitlin Schneider, and I'm a staff writer at Mental Floss.
Neither does Caitlin, though she does like to speculate. Caitlin is mildly obsessed with unexplained sounds, and she wrote about a few of her favorites for Mental Floss. And as is so often the case with radio producers,
After I read her article, her mild obsession became mine. All right, let's take a closer listen to that sound I played a minute ago. It's called upsweep.
You can hear it's like a strange, I mean, it's called upsweep because it sort of has that like train of upsweeping sounds that last a couple seconds.
Okay, that is pretty weird. But how do they even record these unexplained sounds in the depths of the sea? Well, in 1991, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration started conducting underwater surveillance. They planted water-tolerant microphones called hydrophones all along the ocean and then pressed record. Upsweep has been there from the beginning. After all these years of recording this absolutely bizarre sound, there must be some theories. But what do scientists think it is?
It's always there. They don't know what it is. The leading theory is that it has something to do with volcanic activity, but they don't really know for sure. If I were to just listen to that clip, that's certainly not what would come to mind. As all of these ocean sounds, I think a creature is, because it just sounds so spooky and like something lurking in the deep and probably like something we've never seen before.
Upsweep is a spooky sound, but not as spooky as the unexplained sound from the ocean known as Julia. Okay, that is way stranger than upsweep. Is it an animal we've never heard of, like searching for a mate, or a ghost submarine left over from the war, or maybe something alien?
Julia is sort of, in some ways, a creepy one because there's so little information about it. It lasts about 15 seconds. As you can hear, there's sort of that one part where there's sort of a distinct cry sound. You can hear something that sounds sort of like a whale. And it was loud enough that it was picked up by the entire hydrophone array.
Not all mysteries of the sea are the stuff of nightmares. Some are just sad.
It begins back in 1989 when the U.S. Navy first heard a mysterious sound picked up on the top secret network of underwater microphones that had been used to track Russian submarines ever since the Cold War. Scientists deduced this mysterious sound was coming from one single whale who had been calling out at 52 hertz, a frequency that no other whale could understand. Now it's believed that this whale has lived his entire life in complete solitude, swimming all alone through the Pacific, calling out, yet never once receiving a response, earning him the nickname, the loneliest whale in the world.
That's Adrien Grenier of Entourage fame and his partner, Josh Zeman, telling this sad and mysterious story of 52, the loneliest whale. They successfully raised over $400,000 with the help of 3,800 backers to go in search of this creature. Caitlin is among the many people that are hopeful they will successfully find more information on the loneliest whale.
Its call is not like any other whale, and therefore it sort of roams the ocean alone and is really sad and lonely. And I love this one because it's different from the others in that it's not scary, but it's just so strange to think that this enormous animal is wandering the ocean by itself.
While the ocean seems to be the primary source of unexplained sounds, there are a few sounds on Caitlin's list that you might get a chance to hear without the help of an underwater hydrophone array, like the hum. People have reported hearing this mysterious sound across the globe for years. The sound even made its way to a baseball game in Florida.
And the bunt is foul. The count is 1-1.
What could that possibly be? Somebody shut the door.
It sounds supernatural.
That recording was taken at Tropicana Field during a game between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Detroit Tigers back in the summer of 2001.
Bringing out all the stops tonight in order to take down Verlander.
I haven't heard anything that bad since we had that Vuvuzela night.
The same week, an earthquake measuring 5.8 on the Richter scale hit the East Coast, which some propose might be the source of the sound.
Just as we mentioned that, it stops. Maybe we figured it out.
According to a field reporter who was at the game, the noise was feedback from speakers that were hit by a direct lightning strike. For most of these unexplained sounds, science can provide a perfectly logical explanation for a possible origin. But
rarely is there any proof. It's easy to find people who have alternate theories for where these sounds come from, but that's an entirely different kind of internet rabbit hole. Despite the difference of opinions, for Caitlin, seeking out unexplained sounds and trying to figure out where they come from continues to be a favorite distraction.
It's a different kind of way of seeing wonder in the world that I think is not generally thought of. You know, strange sounds are not the sort of mysteries that we usually turn our focus to. And I think when you start thinking about it, it does sort of become one of those things that starts to pop up in your mind that wasn't there before.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Logan Shannon.
And you can listen to more Unexplained Sounds and read a few theories by following the links at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thinking of posting something online? Well, be sure to avoid committing word crimes.
Word crimes, like I could care less. That means you do care. At least a little moron.
That's Weird Al Yankovic doing his bit for good grammar, and he is not alone. The Grammar Police bot scans Twitter and other online posts for mistakes, which are then outed in persnickety tweets like this one. It looks like at Stockholm Harry should have tweeted, and then he shows himself instead of than, T-H-A-N. It isn't an adverb. Tisk, tisk. Andrew Heisel is a writer who knows his grammar, but is not ashamed to admit that he still makes mistakes. He wanted to find out why and wrote for the Washington Post about why our brains make us write not so good. Andrew Heisel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you're big enough to confess that you do make grammar fumbles and that you occasionally take pleasure in the mistakes of others. What are some of the most common grammar mistakes made online?
The number one mistake seems to be your, Y-O-U-R, for your, Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, or vice versa. And other similar homophone slips like that, like than for than, like you mentioned, like the wrong it's with apostrophe or without, or right for right is one that I've made occasionally. You don't see that often, but I'll type it, and I shouldn't. I'm a writer. I know how to write, but I still make that mistake all the time.
Well, you looked into why. When we know the rules, we still mess up. Is it just laziness or going too fast?
I think speed definitely plays a factor into it, and you could say laziness is there, but it's mostly from these cognitive psychologists that I talked to about the way that the brain processes language, so that when you're going to select a word, first there's a part where you figure out what's the word you want, whether you have a range of related words, and hopefully you pick the right one, although often you don't. Then the next stage is sort of sounding it out, or at least usually it's sounding it out. Sometimes it's not. There's a lot of studies on this. But you sound it out, and when you're sounding it out, there's no difference between your and your. And so sometimes the wrong one just comes out. Even when you're writing by hand, this often happens. So it's not really laziness, it's just brain function.
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me, is how much is based on hearing. Now, I can hear a misconjugated verb when someone's speaking, but I get a little judgier, I guess I'd say, when somebody does it in writing or online, especially if they are sounding like a windbag or a grandstander. I mean, does
right.
that happen for you?
Absolutely, and that's one of the interesting things I've noticed. People don't correct routine language errors when it's not in any way sort of a debate. So in an internet forum where people are just talking about their interest in, I don't know, say Star Wars, and they're all in agreement, nobody's going to jump on one another for one of these little errors. But it's when there's something else going wrong, when somebody is saying something you really disagree with about, say, politics, then you go to the next level and you start critiquing their grammar. So it's interesting how some people will say, oh, like, you know, I should correct others because everyone should speak or write proper English. But in fact, when you look at it, it's not that altruistic a motive. People are really interested in belittling others when they have some problem with their politics. At least that's the way it usually seems to play out to me. And that's honestly the way when I'm getting uppity like that, it's probably because first, I didn't like their politics, and so second, I go to their grammar.
You also spoke to a cognitive psychologist studying Wikipedia entries to understand how the brain processes language. What did he find?
Right. And so he's in the middle of the study, so he wasn't really able to give full results. But one of the sort of preliminary theses he has going in is that often a lot of errors are really caused by proficiency. And so you'll see a different body of errors from people who know how to use a language versus ones who are maybe language learners or unfamiliar with it. Some of these errors that you say, oh, you're, you know, as Weird Al says, a moron, you don't know this, are actually because you do sort of know. And what happens are you build up habitual pathways of language use. And so in many contexts, you would use to, T-O-O, and so that's the one that comes out because that's usually the pattern your brain follows in constructing a sentence. And so you use it wrongly, whereas maybe a person who knows the language much less well wouldn't make that mistake because they haven't built up those neural pathways that usually work but sometimes lead to error.
So those are personal habits, Andrew. There are also cultural habits like mixing up 911 and 911. What's going on there?
Right. And so that's a weird one. That surprised me. And I think what's going on there is that sort of habitual pathway thing that the psychologist I talked to, Tom Stafford, talked about, where you see the phrase 911 so often that just typing the series of letters 911, it just comes out as 9/-11, and especially the slash one, that's not really the number. So you're just so used to seeing 911 that it comes out 911. Mm-hmm. I noticed a similar one yesterday. The word segue. When people want to say segued into something, oh, then we segued into this, a lot of people are typing it S-E-G-W-A-Y, as
like
in the
segue, like
motor
the
vehicle.
But doesn't this leave everybody out, Andrew, you know, to say, oh, I blame my brain? I mean, there are reasons that there are rules for grammar, that there's a discipline to it. We need to think these things through. Maybe there's a message here that you shouldn't be tweeting something without really considering it or maybe even proofreading.
Right. And that's a good message. People should proofread. I like to read prose that is clearly constructed and well-written. I think you should do that. But it's also true, and this is another thing that has been studied, that proofreading is not foolproof. As I just mentioned, I proofread that article, reading it through several times, and I still had that error slip. And this is because you're your own worst proofreader, because you sort of lose focus on the words you've written and you're focusing on the meaning in your brain. And this is another thing that's been studied, so that when you see the words, you don't quite see them. You see what you thought you typed, not what you actually typed. This is a problem that you can work around. I like to print things out, or just changing the font to some weird font defamiliarizes it. But you can't do that with Twitter. And Twitter is a very immediate form of exchange. So people probably should proofread their tweets, I guess, but it's not really going to happen. Mm.
I don't think that we should be shaming people publicly, because I don't think that's ever a good idea. But I'm just thinking about upholding the standards of language again. I remember speaking to a teacher a few years ago who said her middle school students pass in essays using the letter U, you know, for Y-O-U, or B, or the number 2, as they would in a text. I'm not saying it's the end of civilization if we let these kind of things slide, but, you know, where does it end?
I get what you're saying. And I've taught, and if I see that in a student paper, I would not be pleased with it either. I'd definitely correct it. I guess what I'm saying with my specific article is that you have to at least allow the fact that some of these things can't be helped because they are about the way our brain functions. But that's not to say that we shouldn't proofread, we shouldn't try to type clearly, and that we shouldn't correct people in the right circumstances. So certainly teachers should correct, certainly proofreaders should correct, and even articles, commenters should correct the grammar in articles too. But when you're just having these sort of low-level exchanges between one another, it seems a little bit useless to correct them. It's a lot like when you're speaking with a person and they're going to slip a lot. They're going to use the wrong pronoun, or maybe some words are going to combine with one another, or maybe they'll grab the wrong one, and you don't correct them because it's sort of tedious. You're being an annoying friend if you do that every time a friend misspeaks. And that's the way I see these sort of low-level engagements on Twitter.
Andrew Heisel is a writer based in New Haven, Connecticut, and we have a link to read his article for The Washington Post, Stop Shaming People on the Internet for Grammar Mistakes. It's not their, T-H-E-R-E, fault. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for your listening time today, and there's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review, pass it along, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.